Hello, you're listening to Spoiler.
Build.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray! Yay.
So guys, once again, we're here to chat about a film and record it for the listening pleasure of whoever clicks on the link. So, hello, link clicker. I'm Richard Nicholas. With me is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
So, guys, the film this week is Manhunter, and it was Jamie's pick. So you can fill in the listener on the details so they don't get it confused with other Manhunter type things.
Okay. Manhunter is a Michael Mann film from 1986. Former FBI profiler Will Graham returns to service to pursue a deranged serial murderer named the Tooth Fairy by the media. It's based on a book by Thomas Harris and adapted by Michael Mann. It stars William Peterson, Kim Greist, Joan Allen, Brian Cox, and Tom Noonan.
It should have been called Michael Manhunter, shouldn't it? Because he made it.
Yes.
Or Michael's Man Manhunter. I'm sorry.
No, you're not.
I am.
You do these things.
So, Jamie, you picked it out. Why did you pick it out? What's your relationship to this film? Go.
I found out about it because I found out that there was a previous Hannibal Lecter, as I didn't realize that there was anything before Silence of the Lambs. And Silence of the Lambs is one of my favorite crime thriller movies, and everybody knows Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of Hannibal Lecter. I would even say that, like, that's pretty much what he's best known for. And it's part of pop culture consciousness, and he's had his own sequels and spin-offs and stuff purely based on that performance in Silence of the Lambs. But this was actually the first film that the character appeared in on screen, and he's played by Brian Cox, who I don't know what people would know Brian Cox for mostly. Maybe
Not the
X-Men 2.
professor, not
Yeah,
the one
not
who's
yeah.
a scientist and ex-band member of
D-Ream.
D-Ream. Or he could be a still a, he could still be in D-Ream, but yeah.
He has the teeth to play a cannibal. But I don't know if he I don't know he if he has that kind of dark charisma. He's a bit too nerdy. But
Yeah, but the actual actor Brian Cox is in
yeah,
loads of
the
stuff.
Scottish actor Brian Cox, who was in X-Men 2 as William Stryker. He was also in the Bourne movies. I can't remember if he was in more than one, or was he just in the first one?
I'm not sure.
Shrug.
But it's not that well known that he played Hannibal Lecter first, and I watched it purely based on that. Like, I was curious to see a different interpretation.
Yeah, that's
And
fair enough.
he's not in it very much. He has like two or three little scenes.
Yeah. Kind of to the detriment, I reckon, of Manhunter. He could have been in it a bit more. I think
Well,
it was an all right version.
it's based on the book Red Dragon by Thomas Harris, and
Yeah.
that's the first book in the series, and I think, or at least I'm pretty sure it's the first book in the series. So he had this bit character who then he
Elaborated on.
He thought, oh, this guy interests me as a character I've created, and then he ended up giving him a bigger role
Yeah.
in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, because I guess in this, he kind of, they don't really elaborate much on who Hannibal Lecter is. They just sort of hint at him being some kind of serial killer and a psychologist. But they don't really get into the whole cannibalism, which is what Lecter's known for that much.
Yeah, that's one of the things about it that I remember reading that they deliberately didn't put too much of Hannibal Lecter into Manhunter because they didn't want him to steal the movie because it was
Yeah.
meant to be about the other guys. But at the
Yeah.
same time, if I didn't know about how can I put this now? If I'd have watched this when it came out and I didn't have the information I have from the stuff that's come out subsequently, I wouldn't really know why he'd gone to see Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, you could have left going, okay, there's history here, but because it, as a standalone film, you don't know why this character is so important to helping him. Like, it's kind of, doesn't quite make sense. It makes sense almost as a sequel to Silence of the Lambs. Like, with someone else playing it, it could replace the film Red Dragon, say.
I think it works as a prequel, but you could argue that it would work better if it did come after, which Brett Ratner remade this in 2002 as Red Dragon.
Yeah.
With Anthony Hopkins as Lecter again.
Mm. Yeah, it could fit in canon, but I think it stands alone to some extent anyway. Abby, what of the Hannibal Lecter canon have you seen before you saw Manhunter, and what were you kind of expecting going in based on that?
I saw Silence of the Lambs, and I saw about 10 minutes of Red Dragon, but I had some expectations of this film based more on what Mark Gurmuth says about it. He just said that it's one of the better movies, and it's a shame it doesn't get talked about. And he's mentioned a few bits and bobs about what it looks like and what it does. I don't remember it especially clearly, but I remember him being positive about it.
And do you like Silence of the Lambs, or?
It's all right. Not amazing.
I think generally though people embrace Silence of the Lambs as being a classic thriller, crime, horror thing. And most people are probably on Jamie's page of it's one of the really good films out there of its type.
Especially of the genre, it's definitely one of the kind of trendsetters. But yeah, it's the one that gets celebrated, whereas Manhunter is kind of a trendsetter by itself as well, but it was kind of a damp squib when it came out because it didn't do very well at the box office. In the years since, it has become like a cult classic.
Mm. I think the reason that I perhaps don't like Silence of the Lambs as much as other people do is because all the things I like about it and are really good about it came from the book, whereas its visual style isn't really all that.
Hmm. I don't know if I agree exactly, but this one, Manhunter, has quite a unique visual style.
It does. They really went to town on this one.
It's called the 1980s.
Mm.
Yeah. but Michael Mann is a really good director.
Yeah.
And it's, in this case, you know, occasionally there's the odd choice of, oh, we have a really blue bedroom. But mostly, it's really visually stunning and some good visual storytelling. And it is very 80s, especially some of the music. I mean, that's one of the things that will strike people is, okay, there's a lot of 80s pop music at times where it just feels odd.
This is one of the few instances where 80s pop has been terrifying.
I think there's probably quite a few instances.
just by itself, usually.
Yeah.
It has a very strong aesthetic, very bold use of colour. I can see the influence of this and films like it on people like Nicholas Winding Refn and his films like Drive and Only God Forgives.
Yeah.
And more recent stuff, like there's a horror movie called It Follows, which is of the kind of John Carpenter ilk, but also you can see a lot of this kind of film, very, not stilted, but... I can't think of any words that aren't negative, like flat or stilted, but very kind of stagey, kind of slow, drawn out, deliberate is a better word, like very deliberately paced, not kind of in your face, over the top.
No. So I like that about it. I also like Silence of the Lambs. I hadn't seen it till the last couple of years, so it was a long time with me not bothering with it, mainly because, cannibalism, that's gross. Like, that's my main thing, is I don't want to see any dirty man eating a body part or whatever. I can't even handle anyone eating a regular liver that you're meant to eat. I put it off, but I eventually came to seeing it. I also, weirdly, I may have seen Red Dragon before I saw Silence of the Lambs, which seems ridiculous. Like, you can't possibly have, because that's quite a weak film. It's okay. It's got you know, I mean, it's essentially, you know, an alternate version to Manhunter, and it was fine. Ed Norton's in it, so he's good, but generally speaking, the film Red Dragon, I didn't find all that intriguing. The story is compelling enough, but I don't know, I didn't get on with that. But Silence of the Lambs is kind of very good. And with this, I'd heard about it. I actually had listened to a podcast talking about it like a few years ago, and hadn't ever had an excuse to watch it myself. And so I was glad when you suggested it. I think overall, I kind of liked it. You know, there was a few things you could criticize, but I think it, you know, if you like Hannibal Lecter, it is certainly, after Silence of the Lambs, probably one of the better sequels. So,
yeah, I mean, you
know. No, go on, I didn't have anything else.
The problem, and I think you were saying earlier about how he's almost not in it enough, and you could say the same thing about Silence of the Lambs as well, but the problem with a character like Hannibal Lecter is it turns out he needs to not be in it very much in order to be as good as he is. Because when you have a film that focuses on him completely, he becomes played out. And
he loses his enigma and his allure as a mysterious figure. In order to keep
that interest going, you have to kind of ramp up the stuff he does until he's almost like a weird superhero.
Didn't that happen with the very last film that they made? I can't remember what it's called now. But it was all about Lecter being out and about in the world.
Wasn't what he did. There was Hannibal Rising, which was the last film they made, I think. Which
they made a TV show as well, didn't they? When he's like younger or something.
Yeah, it's the TV show kind of takes various elements and storylines from the novels and kind of plays them out differently and turns them into a TV show format. I haven't seen it. It looks interesting just because I think Mads Mikkelsen is a good casting choice to play Lecter, but no, Hannibal Rising, I think, was the last film, and that was a prequel about him as a young man, and it was apparently awful.
Well,
but again, that's why,
film...
because it delves into the mystery too much. It answers too many questions. And the strength of this and Silence of the Lambs is he's not in it very much. Like, you are left wondering about him and wanting to find out more.
Mm. Yeah. I didn't enjoy the film Hannibal very much. I think, like you say, too much Hannibal makes him less interesting. And in a sense, Manhunter isn't really about Hannibal Lecter. He's just in it. It's almost like a cameo of a famous character in what is essentially a sort of FBI tracker serial killer movie. You know, like it's just this one guy who is called in because they have a serial killer with a specific MO and they want someone who is good at, you know, thinking like a serial killer, I guess, is our main character's ability, isn't it? What's the main character's called?
Will Graham.
Graham, yeah.
Yeah. And he was the man who caught Lecter, and he's a criminal profiler for the FBI, and he has a knack for getting inside the head of the people they're hunting. And he did that with Lecter, and he ended up on a psych ward because it messed him up so badly that it took him months or years to get Hannibal's thought process out of his head.
Yeah.
And he promised his wife that he would never do it again. And then the FBI come back and say, you know, will you just take a look at this case? You don't have to get involved.
Yeah.
Knowing that he will get, you know, they need him and they kind of manipulate him into doing it. And
of course, his wife is like, oh, don't do it, don't do it. But honey, people will die.
That's the thing. General rule for life, don't ever promise your wife you'll never do something again, because that means that you will.
Yeah, that's a guarantee that you will do it, especially if it's dangerous.
I have to leap headfirst into the mind of a serial killer and look around crime scenes to save people. It's like, oh, you have to save people. That's your clever get out.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, this guy's called in and has to betray what his wife made him promise he'd never do again. And one of the interesting things about the film is this idea that this guy at any point could tip from being a you know, someone who can understand the perspective of serial killers and actually maybe wants to be one himself. Not so much wants to be a serial killer, but has a better understanding that could be pushed and goaded into being, you know, a murderer. Like Hannibal Lecter is constantly trying to poke and prod him and kind of bring him to the dark side a little bit and hint that, you know, you actually are like us, you know, and I think that's what's one of the compelling factors of the film.
Yeah, and it I think he plays it well. William Peterson's performance is very understated. And I think at the time it was one of the detriments of the film. It was one of the reasons it suffered, is because people didn't have a likable, you know, you could have like a likable roguish cop, but instead you've got this quiet, weird, kind of seemingly genuinely dangerous guy just putting his family in danger and getting further and further into the mindset of these dangerous people. And it's hard to latch onto him unless that's what you went in prepared to do.
Yeah, I guess so. And it is kind of creepy the way he has to, you know, walk himself through the crime scenes. And it's quite an effective thing where he's talking himself, kind of berating the serial killers and talking himself through what they might have been thinking. Like trying to really say, oh, what would I be... As a creepy pervert who murders people and does weird stuff, what would I have been thinking as I walk up to this bloodstain? You know, like...
Yeah, it is something that can potentially make it very difficult for an audience, because that's not a relatable thing for most people. And it's asking you to go with him on a very dark journey. I was just going to say, there isn't anyone really in this film to act as a likable hook for the audience. You just have to take your pick of unhinged or unfriendly characters.
Yeah, like there's a journalist who's a bit, you know, yeah, bit of a git and a bit lame. Yeah. And he's obnoxious, but most of the characters, they're all basically doing a procedural part of their job. They're, you know, either setting up, like, you know, it's either the guy in charge of the whole investigation setting up the next thing to do and telling the lab to process whatever and prioritize and telling his men what to do. Or you've got people, cops in meetings. It isn't, there isn't a kind of character bonding thing going on. It's a procedural film where this serial killer guy profiles people and tries to figure out how they think so he can give them, you know, ideas of what to investigate and help them out.
I think it does a very good job of that procedural stuff as well. Like it makes, not all the way through, but for the most part, it makes that stuff engaging, especially when they were doing the forensic stuff with the note found between Lecter and the Tooth Fairy on the toilet paper, and they go through all the different ways of like deciphering what's been hidden on the note. I like the way all that was done.
Sorry. It really helped that they contrived that they had to do it quickly as well, because with stuff like that, it would usually be done slowly and methodically to make sure they didn't miss anything, which is the correct thing to do for solving crime, but exactly the wrong thing for film. So this, it was just everything was compressed down so that they were obviously doing what they needed to do to get the job done, but we weren't wasting a lot of time seeing it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't the usual, oh no, there's like a hostage, we have to save the life of a person. There was the fact that this guy kills every like full moon or whatever, but it was actually about Hannibal Lecter getting suspicious they're onto him. So they had him out of a holding cell, and there was a kind of, he will be suspicious if we take too long here, which is a different route to create urgency in that environment. But I think what is really good about the kind of psychological dilemma that the main investigator, Graham, goes through is just the fact that it kind of at times does suggest he could actually be wanting to be violent himself, or, you know, because there's times where it sort of implies this guy might actually be a nut job, but not like, it doesn't overhandedly do it. It's just like the fact that, like, towards the end, which is quite a good ending really, he decides he's going to rush in and try and save the day instead of waiting for backup. And essentially just full-on pelts it to the house, smashes in head first through a window, and confronts the serial killer himself. I mean, he's got the motivation of, okay, there's a blind woman and she's going to get murdered. And then at the same time, it's like, well, if you wait, the you know, SWAT team will come and it'll all be handled well and you won't get loads of cops killed and yourself, you know, essentially scoop slammed into a fridge and sliced up with a piece of glass, you know?
There's a lot of subtle stuff as well, that there's the strange distance between him and his wife. They've obviously had problems in the past because of everything he's done, but the film doesn't feel the need to massively dwell on it. It just gives you the information and lets you see their relationship, and you can feel that there's difficulty there, particularly for him. Like, he seems to have a hard time going into himself with any depth.
Mm. Yeah.
Which adds a lot to that character as someone who gets in the minds of, you know, disturbed people. Because, it makes him frightened of looking at himself. Which is, I think, it. One of my favorite things that the film does is it reflects that in Dolarhyde, who is the serial killer, the Tooth Fairy. And he's, the motivation for him, as it's revealed later in the film, is he's killing people to make himself, he's never felt loved. So he sets up these situations when he kills people so that the other victims, like, he'll kill a family and he'll set them up so that they can see and that he can see what he's doing, because he needs to feel revered and loved. And then he finally finds someone who treats him like a human being, and she's blind. I like that that acts as his potential redemption. Like, he starts to open up to her just before the full moon, but then he sees her with someone else and he assumes that she's just having an affair with everybody. And that just kills it dead.
The subjective point of view there, actually, when he was looking up at them at when they were standing by her doorway, and the music kicked in and the lights through the door, was like, that's fantastic and awful.
That great, like, he storms off because of what he's seen and what we've seen too. Like, they're basically just making out on the doorstep, and then it cuts back to them, and all that's happened is the guy's just been getting something off her face, and there's been no actual intimacy there at all. But for Dolarhyde, that's it. Like, too late.
Too late, you're getting snagged into a bush in a really comical way and killed. Actually, it's kind of an interesting parallel, because you've got the detective guy who's essentially a good guy who could sympathize, he sympathizes with serial killers in their childhoods, because that's when they're formed and created by their, you know, horrible upbringing. And then you've got Dolarhyde, who's kind of he's kind of like the opposite. So he's crazy and, you know, wants to murder people and fulfill whatever his sick fantasies are. And there's just that moment where he almost comes to the good side, where through meeting this blind woman who takes to him, because she can't see how horrible he looks generally. I mean, that's just aesthetically, he's a bald blonde man who's rather big and slightly weird looking. But she kind of sees past it figuratively and starts sort of seeing him, and they spend a nice night together, and there's that sense of, oh, he could actually come good here, this could be what he needs, is someone to actually love him genuinely rather than him needing to set up the fake murderous situations. And it's interesting that, you know, you got the good guy almost going too dark and the bad guy almost becoming good. That's kind of a nice thing to do.
A clever thing that the film does with that is that at that point, Will Graham's been the protagonist, but he's not been out of his way, like, likable.
Mm.
Whereas when Dolarhyde's first introduced, it's when he's horribly murdering Lowndes, the journalist.
Yeah.
And then, but the more you see him, the more human he becomes, to the point where he's almost the most human of all the characters until he snaps and feels betrayed, and then he transforms completely into the red dragon that he sees himself being, you know, becoming.
I think that's what makes it more shocking.
Yeah, because he's the only, like, almost the only human character to a point.
Well, he's still always pretty creepy. He always seems to be, situation, he seems to socially not be comfortable.
But he also, there's a vulnerability to him that is more on the nose than it is with a lot of other characters.
You want him to get better.
Yeah, and once he starts, horrible. Yeah, Like, he's so close.
Yeah, but he's irredeemable as well. Even if he did become good, you'd be like, it's not good enough. It's too late. And one of the other things you want is you want him to take that weird stockings off his head, which he puts on for some reason. Like, he just covers his head with the stocking a bit while he's talking to the journalist and in his horrible shirt.
I took that for one of those moments when, because he doesn't do it again, it's one of those moments where you've tried something, it didn't work, but you've done it now. You just have to live with it.
So you think he went for it thinking, oh, this looks cool and intimidating. I feel more like a dragon when I've got my mum's stocking on my head. I don't know what, like, I was expecting that to be, like, I don't know, part of his ritual or something, but it didn't really come up again.
Yeah, kind of like he's very similar to Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Hills. They're very similar characters, and they're going through a very similar, like, they're both going through a transformation, or they're trying to go through a misguided transformation.
Yeah. Which I guess is why Hannibal Lecter is able to understand him more, and, you know, essentially he's just, you know, Hannibal Lecter is used because he's a psychological, because he's
a doctor before he was a...
Yeah, he's a psychiatrist.
So yeah, his psychiatry background plus his serial killer background allows him to think and understand these people. Yeah. And, you know, because he's famous for being in the newspapers and all the weird stuff he done, this is why I guess I couldn't remember his name because you said the other guy's name now.
Dollarhide.
Dollarhide. Yeah.
So yeah, they have this pen pal relationship
through the newspaper. That's all part of the procedure, is trying to decode these messages. They find out there's messages going between them, then they have to decode them, and then they want to try and set up fake messages, but they don't have time. You know, it's a really compelling part of the investigation. Is this sort of how do we figure out how to stop people communicating and stuff?
Thinking about that and the relationship between Lecter and Dollarhide, one of the things I liked is that this is the only film with Hannibal Lecter that I've seen where he's like out and out the bad guy, because he sets up Dollarhide finding out where Will Graham, he wants revenge on Will Graham for putting him away. And like in Silence of the Lambs, Lecter is helping Clarice. And not only is he helping her with the Buffalo Bill case, he's trying to help her come to terms with an element of her past because he's fascinated with her. Mm. So there's a degree of Lecter being this kind of fascinating monster. And then as the films go on, they make him like more and more kind of sympathetic, or they try to.
Which is kind of weird, actually. That's one of the ways I think the other Hannibal Lecter films fall down, is they make him sympathetic when you shouldn't really be rooting for him and liking him. You should be thinking, this is a selfish psychopath weirdo.
And I think that's one of the strengths of this one, is that he is just the bad guy. And this is the only one where he is just flat out the bad guy.
Well, when Graham goes to see him to get some... essentially, there's two motivations. He wants help, you know, figuring this out. So maybe help, like, offering Lecter like the files, giving him something to study. He's essentially bored in this cell if he doesn't have anyone coming there and, you know, I guess giving him anything Lecter could find interesting.
Someone he can mess with.
Yeah, that's it. He wants a person across from him to mess with, and he would quite like to know more about this serial killer, presumably. But there's the added aspect of, well, you're going to Lecter, and obviously, you and him are both aware he's going to try and mess with you. He knows he's intelligent, and Graham knows he can't. Like, that's what's kind of good about the tension, is he doesn't want to say anything. He doesn't want to give Lecter too much emotionally or information about Graham, because he knows how Lecter can trick him into giving him more or finding out pertinent information. And essentially, by him going there, Lecter does end up interfering in Graham's life. You know, he uses the telephone, and somehow chewing gum wrappers can be used to mess with dial tones, and he gets himself...
Oh, you've got to love old telecommunications, don't you?
Yeah.
Does that work? I just put this chewing gum wrapper in here, that messes that up, and I'll make loads of innocent phone calls to secretaries.
I remember reading the Anarchist Cookbook back in the day, and that was one of the things that they talked about, is how to hack payphones and stuff like that.
I did laugh, and I'm pretty sure it's intentional, when Lecter tricked his way into one phone call by saying he doesn't have the use of his arms.
Yeah.
And it was just the flat out sudden statement just made me laugh out loud.
It's just the way he says it, yeah.
Yeah. I like Brian Cox's performance as Hannibal Lecter because it's so different from Anthony Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins plays it very
sinister.
Yeah, like he plays it evil.
Yeah.
And creepy. Whereas Brian Cox plays it creepy in a real life psychopath kind of way.
And he's sort of smug, and there's the only other scene he has, because he has the sit down with Graham on the other side of the kind of plastic and bar cell, and it's all like white, and it's quite a good sense of, we can't give this guy anything. Like they create a sense of, what's up with it? Why is this guy so dangerous that you've had to make everything minimal and kind of not give anything to him because he's that, you know, clever. Anyway, so that's the first scene, is Graham meets him in his cell, and then later on he has a phone call with him, and I like that when we show Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter, he's sort of lying in his bed with his feet up on the wall, and it's a bit more like a flirting teenage girl having a chat, and it's just a lot more, I'm enjoying this now, rather than I have to trick you. Like, he's already knows a lot, and he's, you know, got his plans. Yeah, so anyway, aside from Brian Cox playing it a little bit like a teenage girl, not too much, but he creates a sort of smug intellectual vibe that I find compelling.
I actually want to talk about our phone call just a little bit more, because I also love the voice that he put on when he was talking to the secretary, and just like, oh, hello! I bet if you look at that Rolodex, you'll find it for me.
Yeah.
Thank you!
It just even tells her, like, you know, basically the alphabet, so that she, like, what a G, and it's just like, well, yeah, that's his surname, but, you know, he's just deliciously smug and knowing. Like, he seems to be so clever that he'd know everything, like, even that, you know, even, and then off the cuff, when things aren't quite, I didn't guess exactly right, I could still interpret where else to look or how else to convince someone to give me information.
Yeah, he's playful.
Yeah, playful,
and
yeah.
When things are going his way, he really enjoys himself.
He has been dying for something to do this whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's one of the elements I think lets it down, is he is so compelling as a character, and the way Brian Cox plays him, is you do want more information about Hannibal Lecter. I mean, we don't really get a sense of his back history, which is why it feels like a prequel to Silence of the Lambs, is because it's going into it with the assumption that you've seen Silence of the Lambs works because you already know. You're like, oh, I know this guy. He's always like this, you know?
I think watching them one after the other as well, watching Manhunter and then watching Silence of the Lambs soon after, the arc of his character would be very satisfying. To see him go from what he does in Manhunter and then be given more to do in Silence of the Lambs until he escapes. And you've got that last shot of him just
spoilers.
Wow. But like, I think they work very well together as a film and its sequel. I think it's kind of a grey area whether Silence of the Lambs is officially considered a sequel or not. You do get like, you can get like DVD box sets that have this Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal together. But I think they work very well as like companion pieces, and I think they tell the story of Hannibal Lecter in a really satisfying way, and I think there's no need for any of the rest of the films after Silence of the Lambs. Whereas this one actually adds to, like, they complement each other very well.
Yeah. Well, Manhunter, because that's what we're supposed to be talking about, I guess. Manhunter in itself is like, the format is the same. It's an investigator needs Hannibal Lecter to help solve a crime. That's essentially the Hannibal Lecter gimmick, he's approached by people who have to give a little bit of themselves that gets manipulated, and that's how they get a bit of, okay, I've got some ideas now because I've talked to Hannibal Lecter.
It is basically the same story both times. The only difference is in Manhunter, you've got Will Graham, who's already familiar with Hannibal Lecter intimately, whereas in Silence of the Lambs, you've got a newbie coming in who knows about him but doesn't know him and gets like sucked into his manipulation and his games.
I think one of the key things with Graham and Hannibal Lecter, though, is this idea that Hannibal Lecter knows he's not there to talk to him as much as he is there to get the set. He calls it the get his scent, the feeling of being a serial killer, for like kind of rub off some of that creepy madman that you must or can only get from a sit down with this guy. And as the scene ends where they've chatted to each other, you know, and Graham's tried to give very little, but you know, and is saying, look, I know who you are. I'm not an idiot. I'm going to give you the bare minimum and I'm going to treat you like you need to be treated, you know? But then by the end, he still has to kind of get out of there really quickly because he's getting too much from those emotions from the, you know, stopping Lecter the first time are coming back, and possibly that feeling of being a monster himself is getting to him.
That reminds me of a scene quite late on in the film that is a really nicely done scene that is ruined by some terrible continuity.
Go on.
It's the supermarket scene with Graham and his son.
Yeah.
Where he finally explains what happened and why he went to hospital and getting into Lecter's mind and everything. And it's a really well done scene. Like, the dialogue is really good. The kid's not great, but he's a child actor. Like, 90% of them are atrocious. William Peterson's performance is really good because he does that difficult but finally starting to reveal stuff and stuff he's obviously never told his son.
Yeah.
But I couldn't take my mind off the fact that they go to another aisle in the middle of a sentence. They're in a supermarket and they've got all these products behind them. And then, like, one shot goes to the son who's saying something, and then it goes back to Will Graham, who's answering the question, and suddenly there's completely different things behind him.
Well, they're supposed to be walking down a cereal aisle.
No, they've stopped. and they're in the cereal aisle, and then they ask a question, and then suddenly they're in the coffee aisle, and everything's different.
Did that actually happen? When I was watching this movie, it just so happened that I looked away and then looked back during that scene, and I thought this looked different.
It's just a continuity error. They don't move.
Well, one of the weird things with that scene is you do find yourself going, I like this in a supermarket, because that's, it feels like films avoid supermarkets because there's too much legal problems with filming with brands everywhere. But I did find myself looking at all the American brands from the 80s and looking at the old designs going, oh, look at that. What's that? What's Total? Like, you know,
Folgers coffee.
So it's a bit distracting, and it takes away from what is a great scene, and I think is one of the key scenes to showing how Graham is actually a good guy.
I was gonna say, I agree with you, it's nice that it's in a supermarket, because the supermarket's one of my favorite places, so it's always nice to finally see a scene in one.
Do a bit of mental shopping. I need to get some of that. But I think it proves that Graham is a good guy, because when he talks to his son, he leaves out the gory details, but he essentially talks to him sensibly and basically says, you know, I had problems, I had to see doctors, and I got better. And there's a sense like, okay, maybe you could go bad again, but at least he's being honest and open, and not, you know, he's essentially saying to his son, you can trust me. And I know it must be weird for you, and you must be a bit frightened, but
it is
I'm
a
aware
nice touch
of myself.
It is a nice touch to what you just said about he's still, despite everything he's been through and how, like, not quite right, he still has the wherewithal to not describe to his son, because the son asks, like, how did Lecter kill these girls? And he just kind of says, in bad ways, and he doesn't elaborate on it. Which, you know, if he was coming unraveled, he'd just get, or especially because he's been in Lecter's mind, he'd just get really into it and describe all the horrible details.
Just reach for a coffee jar and smash it open and hold it to his son's neck. He had him like this, and he used to cut out their eye, you know. Like, yeah, but I thought that was just one of the good ways to say, look, he's not completely nuts. He is our good guy. He's our sort of one to, we don't have to worry too much. But there's still a sense of, well, I was bad before, and it really messed with me, and I might not be strong enough to, you know, make it through this. Actually, I just remembered a really great line and scene I liked, because that was such a good scene. I also, back at the Lecter chat, as we should call it, in the white room, the best line in it for me was, he's talking to Lecter, and Lecter's like, you think you're cleverer than me? And he's like, no, I know I'm not cleverer than you. But you know, because I caught you, but I caught you because I had you had like what did he say?
He said, "No, I know I'm not cleverer than you. You just have certain disadvantages. What disadvantages? You're insane."
Yeah, it's like, oh, absolutely owned him. You're insane. So I caught you. It's like,
I know you're a very intelligent man, but you're absolutely mental. You eat people. There's something wrong with you.
Yeah. And in a way, I didn't really get how Graham Cotton caught him. Because when he explains to his son, he says, well, he had a book of war wounds in his office. It's like, was that enough? I mean, that's a sign that he's weird, but I don't know. We need more, really.
I think that's fine, because the idea is that he's got into his head and he saw that book and he was like, oh, that me too. Yeah, that it's him. But what didn't make sense is when he said, I went down and called the police. It's like, well, what is that? Are you going to tell them that?
Yeah, is that the evidence you gave? You went to court and said he's got a book. It's horrible.
Luckily, Hannibal decided to attack him, so, you know, kind of proof positive. But, you know, I just thought that was a great moment. And, you know, a lot of the time, you know, the dynamic with Graham and other people, like his people he's working for and the reporter and stuff, is he's a more shy, quiet guy. And they just sort of trust him. Like, they trust that he knows what he's doing, and they're anxious to get more information. I thought, actually, I don't know who, like, I don't know what police rank he was, but the guy with the mustache, grey hair, what was his name? He's quite a good actor. I can't think who. Crawford.
Jack Crawford.
Jack Crawford. And who is he played by? Does anyone know who he's played by? Because I do like him. He's in loads of, like, crime films and stuff.
It is Dennis Farina.
Okay. Well, I thought his role, because he plays it like a regular, you know, investigator, a good, reasonable guy, but he hasn't got the mind of a serial killer to use to figure out why glass is broken or what the guy's done.
Talking about Will's relationship with different characters as well, what I like is that apart from his wife and his son, most people in the film are using him in some way or manipulating him in some way. Like Jack Crawford called him in saying that, oh, we just want you to have a look, but it says, like, Graham says later, and Crawford admits it. Yeah, he was going to go back into it 100%. And he did. He manipulated him into doing it. And Lecter manipulates him.
The press guy.
Yeah, Lowndes manipulates him. Like, he's being used all the time. And he knows as well, but he's so involved in what he's doing that he can't stop.
Like, he's almost addicted to doing it. Like, you get a sense that perhaps he's not doing it. Because he always is crossed. Like, he hates the idea of these, like, psychopaths doing stuff. But he also, there's a sense, like, maybe he's addicted to reliving voyeuristically through them. Like, he's not a serial killer, but he gets to stand in their shoes in his job. Yeah. And maybe he likes doing that. And that's, again, working on that ambiguous, does he do it for good reasons, or does he do it because he's one himself, you know?
Yeah.
Is he a Dexter kind of character?
I think that's part of the film's strength with its actual style, like the visual style, the music and all that kind of stuff. That deliberate and kind of surreal feel that it all has.
Mm.
It enhances that disconnection of his character.
Yeah.
Like, it makes it really plays on his being lonely and kind of disconnected, separate from everyone else.
Hmm.
And there's a really nice sense of isolation with Dolarhyde and with Graham. Like, the duality between them both is really well done. They both feel like lonely people.
Yeah. I guess that's the other key story, really, is we get quite a lot of you know, who Dolarhyde is, like, because he's this large, balding, blonde man, you know, but we find out that he's going to this photo development place, and that we essentially, we see him, you know, invading people's houses, but we, you know, luckily we don't see much. I think it holds off on gore. It doesn't want that to be what the film's about, which I was glad, because too much gore makes it, you know, it's better to leave it in our imaginations in a way.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But part of the drama of his story is this incredibly tense and awkward relationship he has with this blind lady who likes him and is fine with him, but doesn't know that he's a complete nut job and can't see his world. You know, she could maybe get clued in a little bit. Not a lot, because, you know, having a big poster of the moon and the odd little things in his house aren't that weird. He's not, like, got a sick, twisted basement of torture. He lives in a sad-looking 80s apartment or house. And it's just that incredible, oh, don't. It's so awkward when he's watching the footage of the families he's murdered and she doesn't know and he's just having casual chat with him. It's just that, oh, just constantly, don't. Don't do it. Oh, you're going to sleep with him. No. You know? How do you guys feel about that element of the story?
I liked it just because it's the potential redemption.
Mm. Definitely.
Like, I like that whole little arc that he has where he almost manages to escape what he's becoming.
Yeah.
But then his own paranoia and jealousy is what ruins it for him.
Yeah, you get a sense generally like he can't stop himself being sick either and wrong.
I liked his, once he's killed that guy who he thinks she's cheating. Like, he's seen her once, but it's like, and she calls him Francis and he says Francis is gone forever.
Yeah.
So like the last of his humanity is gone. He's reborn, which is what he wanted.
And he's interestingly lame as well. Even like you get a good sense of him when he kidnaps the reporter guy and has him read out rubbish on his tape recorder, and like, you know, you can see he's got issues with, don't call me, I'm not gay, okay? So I want apologies and stuff. It's that kind of petty serial killerness of pathetic man.
It was interesting because a lot of films like this tend to fetishize their serial killers.
They're really kind of cool, even though they're sick.
Or even make them like all powerful. Or, you know,
too clever or something. This guy's a bit of an idiot.
He's kind of sad, and he's sad and he's lonely, and he's just not a very well put together person. And his physical appearance as well, like, he's tall and strange looking and like awkward, and also wants things that other normal people want. He's not a monster in the sense that, like, I don't know, someone like Michael Myers would be.
He's, you know, what he wants, a bizarre, he's got just a weird thing of, I want seemingly to become some kind of demonic dragon, but at the same time, actually, that's what doesn't fit really. He wants to be this dragon, but then he also wants to be a loved person. Like, he just wants to be like a family man or something.
I think that's probably one of the film's weaknesses, is it doesn't quite explore his motivations enough. Yeah, I'm not saying you have to go back into, like, his childhood and his relationship with his mother, but, like, a little bit more about the transformation, like, what he's actually hoping to become.
Because he seems to talk about it as if he wants to become a dragon, and Graham reads it as he wants to be loved, and at no point does he come across like he wants to be loved, maybe the blind woman when she sleeps with him, and even when he has, like, her hand, he puts her hand on his face, and he's kind of... He seems to be in a special kind of bliss or something. He looks really like, almost like he's become good, but also like there could also be a sick look in his eyes. He's got a brilliant ambiguous, you feel innocent or you feel wrong, you know?
That's the thing. It could be that the film is deliberately kind of blurring it and that we don't know what his motivation is because he doesn't really either. Like, he's just grasping in the dark at whatever he can find because he comes across as completely lost.
Well, it's that thing, isn't it, of it doesn't really, you know, maybe the Red Dragon persona for him is how he sees himself, but really the psychological evaluation of him is he's a lonely man who wants to be loved. Like, maybe his rituals for him aren't pretending to be a loved family member, but for him is something far darker, but actually it's manifesting in a way that betrays his reason. But it maybe it is a little bit, those two parts don't fit together, you know?
Yeah, it could have been clearer, maybe? I don't know.
Like, it could have fitted better, couldn't it? The pieces could have come... Like, when you watch the film and the last piece goes in place, you go, oh, it makes perfect sense. Like, it's like you kind of go, well, Graham was right, but also he wasn't right because the guy thought of himself in a different way that isn't explained and isn't given reason.
The problem is you'd have the risk of, like, you need to toe the line. I think this film doesn't give quite enough, but at the same time, you risk giving too much and just beating your audience over the head with... Mm. You know, oh yeah, his mother turned him upside down when he was a baby, and now he, like, it's, which a lot of other films like this are, you know, do suffer from, where they just go way too much the other way and just explain everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it might be a stylistic choice, because this film is, it's a lot more abstract than I was expecting.
Yeah.
That was one of the criticisms of it from a lot of people when it first came out, is that it was just kind of weird. Like, it didn't try and be especially realistic.
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't get too mad, though, either. I don't really have too many criticisms of that element of it.
It was originally going to be directed by David Lynch.
Oh, right.
Ooh, that would have been interesting.
Yeah. It would have been upsetting and nauseating.
Yeah. I'm glad Michael Mann had his hands on it, because, you know, it's a manly film at times. He has moments where the main character must make love to his wife in an all blue lit room, and but it isn't overly men with guns running down streets and hard men talking. I think, you know, it's a little more lighter than Michael Mann usually is.
That might be another reason it suffered as well, is because it wasn't guns blazing, you know, from the director of Miami Vice kind of.
At the same time, it did feel like the same world. It seemed like an episode of Miami Vice that got a lot darker. Tubbs didn't come in at the end and say, like, something funny to make the episode end.
Yeah.
Abby, what did you make of... I mean, because it did get a bit Michael Mann-ish and guns blazing at the end. It inserted man smashes through window, you know, fight, shotguns, cops being killed. What did you make of the ending, Abby, particularly?
I liked the ending. Because everything had been simmering away for so long, and everything had been so tense, it really needed to blow off in quite a spectacular way. But it didn't go crazy about it. It is ridiculous that he burst through the window, yes. But it was not like there were vans exploding everywhere and a massive bloodbath, per se.
Yeah. There was still some continuity errors, though, because it looked... I don't know if it was just me, or like if my copy was dodgy, but... Some of the shotgun, like even when Dolhide got shot, there was like weird edits that didn't seem like it was one continuous scene. It kind of looked wrong. Do you guys have that as well?
I think it was, I assumed it was deliberate to make it disorientating.
All right, because I just thought it was amateur.
I don't know if, like, I know this was one of Michael Mann's first major movies, which I also think contributed to a couple of problems I had with it. Like, one of the problems I had with it was a bit too slow in places, and I felt like it was padding itself out to fill out the runtime. And I wasn't sure if that was because he had come from TV, where he had been used to being restricted to half an hour.
Yeah.
And suddenly he had 2 hours plus to play around.
Oh, let's have him on the beach making a little, enclosure for turtles. So we'll have something at the end to be wholesome, to cleanse the palate. Oh, look, the turtles all lived because, what does that got to do with anything, I guess?
I think, like, this was, you know, this was early in his career, so it was before he had completely refined his own style. This was before, you know, Heat, which is the, I think a lot of people consider, like, the peak of Michael Mann's career.
Mm. I haven't seen that, but you have, haven't you, Rich?
Yeah, I have a hate-like relationship with it, because I first watched it, I didn't care for it. And then after every subsequent watch of going, was I fair on Heat? Because I thought it was a bit of a meh crime movie. And then I watched it again, and it's better than I thought. And like I watched it for a third time, and I was like, oh, it is actually all right. I'm not in love with it, but I respect it. And it's a very, you know, bloke thriller, I think.
Yeah. It's very long as well. Maybe Collateral might be a better pick, because that's shorter and more tense.
Well, Collateral is one of my favourite films of his. And Tom Cruise, actually. It's one of the few things I can stand him in. like that and Rain Man. And even then, in Rain Man, he's kind of Tom Cruise-y obnoxious purpose. Anyway. Well, you know, we have the dramatic ending. Graham sort of betrays himself a little bit by rushing in, suggesting that he maybe does want a bit of danger in his life, but also saves the woman, but then gets cops killed, but then he saved the day, and then he's happy with his wife and his child and his helped the turtles back to the beach, setting up the film Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. No, you know, so it's got a kind of positive ending. He's got a little bit of a scar from it because he did get a little too close to the fire, sort of thing. You know, he got too close and he got cut by a serial killer, and I think that's a fair, you know, trade-off. So it has a fairly good wrap it up nicely ending. It does leave the Lecter side of things a bit, you know, irrelevant though, to some extent. Like his sort of,
well, the whole reason Graham ended up going after Dolarhyde with the enthusiasm he did is because Lecter gave him his home address. Like, he put his family in danger of Dolarhyde as a revenge for putting him away.
Yeah. But they move and avoid that. They're in a safe house. And then when it's all over, it's like, well, Hannibal Lecter managed to get your address without you telling him it. Like, without having any way to get your address, he got your address. I can't happily live forever after in that house now. There's a madman who could give your address out to any psychopath that's sending him love letters, basically.
That's probably why, like, I don't know, you could explain that if you watched Silence of the Lambs afterwards. Like, suddenly there's even more security restrictions on Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. So, you know, I think generally, though, Manhunter is a really good film. And like you said, you know, partway through, it is a good companion piece for Silence of the Lambs. And if you want to extend Silence of the Lambs' universe, that's the one I would opt for.
What I think is nice about it is that you can watch them for the first time in any order and still get the same kind of satisfaction out of it. Like, you can see Silence of the Lambs first, which I imagine most people at this point would have, and then go back and watch Manhunter and get a little more of the backstory of Lecter, even though he's played by a different guy. You see a different aspect of him. Or you can watch Manhunter first and follow it up with Silence of the Lambs and watch that character explored in more depth and given more to do. But they work well together because they are basically the same story, just with different, a different protagonist, a different antagonist, and more like different aspects of the character who they go to for help.
Yeah. Well, it's like why people go see plays of the same, you know, story. They might see the same play by different actors in a different director in a different theatre. Yeah. And it's just, you know, see basically the better version of the Red Dragon story, which I think is far superior to the one that came later, just because it sort of understands what's compelling, and it's the fact that you've got these two, you know, characters who have parallels. Like, this, the guy that the hunter and the hunty are similar. Like, you have to you have to enjoy the fact that they both can understand what it's like to be in that mindset. Just one has gone there and one nearly does but doesn't, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think it's really good. I can't possibly think of a rating other than what serial killer is it? Is it more of a Ted Bundy? Or, you know, like, I can't really think right now. But has anyone else got last thoughts and maybe a rating we could go with? What sharp object? Is it a piece of glass? Or the rather sharp, like, paper opener that the guy who read the toilet paper message had? I thought that was kind of symbolically similar.
I was thinking about going with a homonym myself and trying to think what cereal they are.
Yeah, we had the cereal aisle and we had serial killers. That's very good. What cereal? I'm thinking about it. Abby?
As we've said most of the way through this, we like it as a movie. We like its visual style. I can see how some people might think it's a bit weird looking rather than weird movie, because when you watch any film about a serial killer, it's weird because he's a serial killer. Mm. But the sort of expressionistic lighting and stuff like that, that is a little bit of a taste thing, I think.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
As for a serial, I'm trying to think of one that you have to have the taste for because it looks weird. But I don't know enough about cereal. I have a weakness here.
There must be something that, you know, divides taste. I mean, some people quite enjoy Weetabix. They're a little bland, but some people love them. And then other people taste them and they go, this is like eating absolute dust and sticks. Like, it's just rubbish pulp, you know? And then other people are like, oh, it's really nice. You should try it with strawberries. You know, so in a way, I would suggest Weetabix.
I'll take that, yeah.
That's nice. You just take that. I'll come up with another. I don't care. So you're saying Abby.
I'm saying that it's Weetabix because some people taste it and think it tastes like dust and straw. But other people taste it and think, I might have this with some strawberries.
Thanks for blatantly. And how does that relate to the film? See, as you picked it, elaborate on it if you want to keep that one.
I already elaborated in the postfix to my choice of cereal, which I saw from you.
Okay, so you're saying it's not for everyone, but it's a mainstay at the breakfast table, and it's a really good film that stands up as well.
I also shows a prefix there.
Sure. Well, you know, yeah, maybe it does need a bit of sugar to help it along. There are flaws in the plot, or little things you could criticism in this and that, but a little bit of sugar, a little bit of sympathy helps it out. Have you got anything, Jamie?
I think it's a really solid film. It's really competent. It has a lot more depth to it than you would assume when you read like a synopsis. And it doesn't give you that depth. It doesn't beat you over the head with it. You have to sit there and think about it. It doesn't spell things out for you. It doesn't hold your hand. It expects you to be an intelligent viewer and to pay attention, which is nice, because lots of films don't do that. It also has a nice visual flair. It's a little bit long in places, maybe plodding, padded out. It's very, very dated.
Yeah.
We haven't gone into a great detail about quite how 80s the film is.
Well, it feels like the Miami Vice, which is the most 80s thing in the world.
But if you're willing to put that aside, or even if you like, you know, if you particularly like 80s aesthetic, then I think that's all more the reason to watch it, because that would just add volumes of enjoyment.
I think my 80s curve is a bit different to other people's because I've seen stuff like Earth Girls Are Easy, where it's basically a parody of the 80s in the 80s. When I see stuff like this, where it's more about jackets and music, I'm like, this isn't that 80s.
It's about jackets and music. They have jackets in the 80s that only existed back then, and it was jackets with patterns on the outside. You never see patterned jackets, and yet they have marks and patterns on them, and it's like, yeah, I know why people don't have those now, but what's the deal with that?
it's just a really solid film with a lot of good depth to it. Nobody gives a bad performance.
Everyone's good. The kid and all.
Yeah, it is a nice companion piece to Silence of the Lambs. I think if any particular fans of that film should watch this, not necessarily expecting the same thing because it is very different.
Yeah,
but they complement each other really well, I think. Serial. I would say it's Kellogg's Crunchy Nut because you have the bland base, like the foundation of cornflakes, but then you have the colorful taste of the whatever the sugar honey goop that they coat the cornflakes in is.
Yeah, it's full of nuts, lots of nuts in it.
So it's that like strong foundation with something a little bit interesting on top, which for the film is the colorful aesthetic and the little touches of abstract surrealism.
Sure.
The problem though is that you're left with that really that gross sweet milk at the end, and that's the padding of the movie where it could have been cut.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, so It's Weetabix, it's Honey Nut. What do you say? Honey Nut.
Kellogg's Crunchy Nut.
Kellogg's Crunchy Nut. Yeah, sorry.
Not that there aren't other, you know, Crunchy Nut equivalent cereals.
No, there's always the knockoff brands. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it's quite a knockoff brand. I think it's rather good. I don't think it's a lesser.
I didn't want to accidentally pimp Kellogg's. Although if they were interested in sponsorship, I'm sure we wouldn't, you know.
Yeah.
You know. Although, you know, as long as no one listens to the Road to Wellville podcast.
Yeah, we do slag off Kellogg's.
You've totally torpedoed that in the past. I didn't realise.
They did it to themselves. I reckon it is Sugar Puffs. Because there's something very 80s about Sugar Puffs. Yeah. Their heyday was in the past where they had the Honey Monster messing around, looking a bit terrifying, which I think is apt for a movie about killers.
I could totally see the Honey Monster as a serial killer.
Yeah, I mean, he's sweet, but he's also a monster, which is kind of which kind of relates to the characters a bit. But it's Sugar Puffs because they're all right, they're tasty, but I never want a whole pack of them. I always like, I'm only ever going to have the small snack size, and then I'm done. I've had my fill of Sugar Puffs, and I can move on. And I think with this, it's like, yeah, it is good, and I enjoyed it, but I don't want too much more. It's like, one of these is okay, but like a whole Miami Vice load. And you're having too much sugar for breakfast, aren't you? You know. So for me, they're kind of the 80s-ness of Sugar Puffs, because they've fallen out of favour. But and you know, in that companion piece thing, maybe you tip your Sugar Puffs in with your Cocoa Puffs, and you get a combination cereal, and it turns the milk dark, and it's still Sugar Puffs. Like, I don't know what I'm saying. There should be some metaphor in there about milk turning the milk dark, because, you know, it does sort of, serial killers turns things dark. Whatever. It's Sugar Puffs because of what I said.
Okay.
What's the catchphrase for the Sugar Puff monster? It's like, time for honey, mummy, or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is. Oh.
I can't remember either, but now
it's
afraid.
Follow me, kids, into the van.
I could pretend to make your children enjoy football and keep fit, but actually I'm plowing them with sugar.
Yeah.
Oh.
Come on, kids, you can run off the diabetes.
Yeah. So that's our thoughts on Manhunter. It is all those cereals in a big bowl. Okay, so I guess that kind of finishes off the podcast. Like a victim of a maniac is dead, bloody, and done, never to happen again. Oh, actually, to happen again next week, because we're serial podcasters.
Nice. Yeah.
Next week, another victim of talking. I'm going to stop. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.